Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. We're just a few days away from the final college football game of the season, the national championship game between LSU and Clemson Monday night. It's no secret to say that college football is a huge business today, with millions at stake over a successful or failing season. But to what efforts would a university or its backers go to ensure success? Well, that's at the heart of Grant Jenkins' first novel, Ivory Tower. Ivory Tower is a campus thriller about Margolie Santos, a film professor who risks her career and even her life as the book ensues to uncover sexual corruption inside our university's football program, where rich boosters pay sorority girls to escort, so to speak, star recruits. The book is a thriller and a critique of higher education's obsession with athletic success. Grant Jenkins is a professor of English at the University of Tulsa who specializes in modern and postmodernist poetry. He's the author of several books of poetry and criticism, but is now concentrating on fiction. He'll be talking about the book this evening and signing it as well in an event at 7 o'clock this evening at Magic City Books. Grant Jenkins is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Grant Jenkins, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.
Now, you've written a number of books, but this is your first novel. You mostly published poetry and criticism. What interested you in writing fiction at this point, especially something like the suspense thriller genre?
Well, as a teenager, I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to be Jack London or Herman Melville sailing the seven seas and writing about my adventures with monsters and extreme weather and the vicissitudes of human life. And
none of this occurs in this book.
No, it does not. And then I realized I needed to learn how to write, so I went to college. And, you know, I still kind of think back and say, maybe I should have gone and lived a little and had something to write about, which is something I always tell my students too, you know, go live and you'll have more material. So I went to college and really discovered I was better at writing about other people's writing. And I put fiction on the shelf, but I also was in school with the likes of Colin McCann and Wes Anderson, who were amazing writers. I mean, you know, the competition was very stiff when it came to fiction, and it still is. But I've returned to narrative. I've written screenplays and short stories and things along the way and have just gotten a story to tell. And I think that's what really brought me back to fiction was this story and its characters just would not go away. And so I decided to take the plunge and write the novel.
And I understand the inspiration for this story goes back a number of years.
Yeah, it does. It hinges on a question that I've been asking myself for a long time, and it goes back to 1987 when Southern Methodist University in Dallas got the death penalty for violating NCAA rules about paying players and other violations. One of the accusations against Southern Methodist during this time was that boosters, you know, these wealthy donors who support the football program in various sort of adjunct ways, paying salaries and building stadiums and things like that, were paying co-ed female students to sleep with star recruits. And it was such a, when I heard this story, it was on a radio, by a radio broadcaster in Dallas on the radio station KLIF. His name is Norm Hitchkiss, one of my favorite sportscasters of all time. I was just floored. I was like, why isn't this
yes, the big story? As opposed to the boosters paying players, yeah, and that sort of thing.
You know, I believe athletes should get remunerated for their labor, and the NCAA for a long time has categorized them as student volunteers, essentially.
But enticing escorts to seduce potential players, that's even further down the road.
Yeah, it's certainly illegal from any light. You know, it's immoral, it's illegal. And I've always wondered, first of all, on both ends, like, what sort of gave these, usually men and pillars of the community, and in fact, the governor of Texas at the time was implicated in some ways with this scheme, you know, why did they think that was a good idea? And then on the other end, how do these women in college who are getting educated and becoming, you know, independent women, you know, what made them think that getting involved or agreeing to this was a good idea or was something that they needed to do? And just sort of exploring those questions is what led me to this, to the subject matter of my book. And then when I sort of met the characters in my head, that's when it took the narrative form that it did.
How common is this, do you think, within college academia and college athletics, where boosters are using sex as an enticement for recruits?
Unfortunately, I think it's more common than we want to admit. I think the biggest story that broke right as I was writing the novel was the University of Louisville basketball program. One of the assistant coaches, and you know, afterwards, the question was, did the head coach know? Did the athletic director know? And they did, of course. But there was the point guy, who was one of the assistants, who had hired a friend to provide escorts for visiting basketball recruits. And she enlisted her friends and even her daughters to participate in this. And she, what made it into the book was that she kept a diary of who was involved, how much they got paid. Like, it was a whole business for her.
It was like a mob ledger.
Yeah, it was, exactly. And I, you know, immediately ripped that from the headlines and put it into the book because it is this kind of emblem of the exchange that's at the heart of this scandal, really. So if it happens in Louisville, who knows where else it's happening?
You know, when you look at college athletics, you know, the whole, where it fits in the whole scheme of academia and of higher education, you know, everybody knows that it's flipped over on its backside. But when you think about that, you know, what gets people exercised is paying athletes, mm-hmm. not this sort of thing. It's almost like it's like a subset. Which to me is sort of absolutely reverse.
And in some ways it's repulsive. And it comes out of the culture of rape, frankly, the sort of acceptance of toxic masculinity. You know, we have this idea of locker room talk and boys will be boys, that these ideas
perpetuated at the highest levels these days.
Yes, at the highest levels of our civic society as well as our government. And that culture is rampant inside pro and amateur sports. And that really is the condition out of which this corruption grows. It's like a perfect, you know, culture for it.
Well, Ivory Tower is very interesting because as a reader, the first few chapters, I thought this was going to be more of a critique and satire of college academic politics and some of these conditions you talk about. I mean, two of the main characters, your protagonist and her husband, who's the head football coach, they're both having affairs with students mm-hmm. or student-age populations mm-hmm. within the first couple of chapters. But eventually this book turns into this and gradually emerges into a thriller. Was that a conscious decision to sort of set the scene of this for the hypocrisy you're going to see during the novel?
I think part of what allows hypocrisy to grow is ignorance. And I wanted to start with characters who were in some sense, either they were blissfully ignorant by accident, they just didn't know, or on purpose. In some ways, I think the head coach is a little bit trying to pretend that this isn't happening. He wants to win football games.
And so that's the reason he's there. And if he doesn't win games, he's out. If he does, he's okay.
Now, Margalia, my protagonist, on the other hand, I think is just a little bit naive when she starts, that, you know, what people are capable of. She kind of thinks everything's normal. She has a great job. You know, students are everywhere, and sometimes they're cute, and she's tempted sometimes. But when things really come down to it, she's surprised by how high the stakes are, that people will be willing to go to such extremes, even to kill, you know, to make sure that this kind of ambition is met.
My guest today is Grant Jenkins. He's a professor of English at the University of Tulsa, teaches literature and creative writing. His first novel is out titled Ivory Tower. It's published by Atmosphere Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the novel follows Margalie Santos, who teaches film studies at the University of Athens, which suspiciously sounds like a real state school in the South. She's married to Frank Sonoro, the football coach, and as we meet them, their lives are a bit in disarray. Frank has had an affair, and Margalie decides to have an affair in revenge, mm-hmm. and very quickly she finds herself in hot water with the administration because the boy she chooses, even though he's not a student at the university, has influence and the ear of the president.
Yeah, his parents are wealthy donors as well to the university, and they get quite upset, as I guess many parents would.
I think all parents.
Yeah, that their child is involved with a faculty member, even if there's not a sort of fiduciary responsibility there.
Or a student-teacher relationship.
Yes. Yeah. And Margalee's life is out of control, so she's not making the best decisions. And not to give too much away about the book, but she pays the consequences for her bad choice with this affair. And I think that's when, going back to the question of when the book changes genres, that's when she kind of has the waking up moment where she realizes, oh, crap, I need to get my life together somehow. And she's a reluctant hero. She doesn't want to take on, you know, this corrupt university system. She just wants to teach her classes and, you know, go home. But it gives her purpose to have something to believe in and to fight for. And we see, you know, she gets to know the women who've been directly affected by this illegal scheme. And I think that's when she finds that purpose, that's when all the stakes get high for her. It really does come down to her, you know, redemption is at stake and her life. It's not just about, you know, her doing good. It's really about her identity. She has to save these people in order to feel legitimate about herself.
And not surprisingly, you made her a very reluctant protagonist. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just been through this situation. She's embarrassed, probably upset, angry at her treatment at the university, and sort of vaguely understanding the circumstances of her dismissal. And she goes into this, the thriller part of the book, sort of reluctantly. She doesn't want to get involved in this.
No, and you know, her life is spiraling out of control, and she reaches rock bottom. And one of the sort of, you know, tricks I use in the book is that each part of the story, she's a film professor.
Right.
So each part of the story involves a different film genre, right? Yeah. So there's the scary part that's the horror, kind of a horror genre, told like a horror film. And then there's the spy part that's not like a spy film. There's a courtroom drama, and I try to incorporate these.
I love the fact that when she's actually brought up on charges for sleeping with this young man, that she's teaching the femme fatale in film noir.
Right. So we see her sort of cast in a certain way. But when she reaches rock bottom, it's the musical, which I thought, you know.
It was.
That's where she sees hope, or it inspires her. And that's when she reaches down deep and makes the decision that she's going to go full tilt against this huge machine of the university and its football program.
And the machine is represented by the president of the university, Art Lightning Lane, who was a football player at one point, who
That's
has
right.
political ambitions, as well as a wealthy donor who just wants to see his university win championships. That's Chet Orchard, who is, you know, how he got so far in business, because he seemed to have like a gangland sort of mentality to him. In fact, as that story's taking part, Margalee is showing excerpts from The Godfather.
Yes. That's right. I had to bring in the gangster genre, one of my favorites. Yeah, even though these men are accomplished, and I wanted to show as well that they really believe in what they're doing. I mean, they're building these institutions and they're supporting things that they believe in, but somehow they've lost their compass or lost the sense of where their moral horizon is, and they're upside down. And how easy that is to happen and how subtly that happens really interests me. Chet Orchard, I took the name from a Tulsan. He was in Ron Padgett's circle. His dad, you know, is a bootlegger. Mm-hmm. And Chet Orchard was one of the sort of petty Tulsa gangsters back in the 30s and 40s.
Interesting.
And I just loved the name, and I had to pilfer that one. But even the name has a Tulsa sort of connection in that kind of gangster background.
It does. But of course, the propelling force in this novel is this overwhelming need for football success that is a part of, I think, any university that has Division I-A athletics. That, I mean, it propels the action of the novel. It propels the sinister force that comes into play, where they're running a sex ring out of a sorority. Mm-hmm. The coercion put on those that sorority and the women that are in it. And everybody associated with it. You come at this from being a football fan yourself. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
I am a huge football fan. I grew up in Texas. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Texas at Austin. It's a lifelong Longhorn fan. Then for graduate school, I went to the University of Notre Dame, which is, you know, maybe the top, you know, historical college football program.
So you're steeped in football.
I am steeped in football. And I guess part of that, you know, gave me insight into this world, you know, my fandom and my interest in the ins and outs of college football gave me a kind of, you know, built-in research for the book. And there are about 60-65 universities in, you know, Notre Dame and Texas are two of them, who make lots of money off of their football program. So it's a multi-billion dollar a year industry. I think in the 2010s, Texas was making $200 million on its licensing alone, you know, its clothing, its logo, anything with its logo on it pays license. So it's not just like people watching football or buying tickets.
The television rights are massive too, but it's everything associated with football.
But it's not just about the money, at least for my characters, I think, and certainly for me. I came to a realization maybe I took it too far when I put my own identity in whether, you know, some 18 or 19 year olds win a football game or not, and I'm upset or depressed because they lose, or I'm elated and feel on top of the world because these boys win. And I wanted my characters to effuse that sense of how the football isn't just about a sport. It is about them. Their team reflects them. So they want to put everything that they have into it and into making it a success, just like they do in their business lives.
Yeah. Of course, this comes at a time when your university, our university, the University of Tulsa, is dealing with its future, and at a time when the whole university is being rethought, but football is still there, unaffected, at a time when you can find more empty seats than filled.
I even wonder.
Was there any commentary on this as a part of writing the novel?
I mean, it wasn't the reason why I wrote the novel, but certainly TU's troubles, its realignment, its financial issues have made me think more about the relationship between higher education and sports programs. I've always been a believer in the efficacy of sports programs as part of an education. Student athletes learn so much more than just through books. Whatever, you know, there's a lot that goes into being an athlete. The student athletes that I've had, almost all of them, have been hard workers. They've been great students. They're dedicated. They're time managers. They don't have lots of free time like other students. They, you know, they have to get their studies done in a certain amount of time, and they really put their shoulder to the wheel for the most part. But I have started to wonder, like, why is the university in the football business? Why are we so dependent on football for our reputation, for revenue? It doesn't seem it's mission creep. It's taken us away from what we're really in the business of, and that is educating young people and providing them with skills and knowledge and creativity that they're going to need to succeed in their own lives. I don't see how football really fits into that, to be honest.
Well, you know, you look at the University of Tulsa. It is, I hate to say it, but it's a fringe program at that highest level. It's not a big state school that is in the top 25 where the money is exponentially larger. You have to ask about those institutions as well.
Yeah, TU is the smallest Division I school that is the smallest student body. So it's already sort of on a razor's edge in terms of its, you know, its ability to maintain a Division I football team that's going to be traveling half of its schedule, that has to have certain kinds of meet certain equipment standards. It has to pay its coaches a certain market value. And usually at a university or even an entire state, the highest paid employee is the football coach.
Right.
Almost always, unless it's a basketball school or a basketball state. But in the United States, most states, the highest paid employee is the football coach at the flagship university. And they're not even professors, you know. Anyway, TU, I think, needs to make a decision about the role of football, and there's several choices they can make. They could totally get rid of football and put its resources into other sports. They could demote football from Division I to Division III, play universities that are closer geographically, so they're spending less time and money traveling, and there'd be less resources expended on coaching. But I think there's also a larger issue that has to do with not just the culture that my novel takes on, which is, you know, a deleterious culture in which people are tempted to do things they might not do because of fame and fortune. but also just the health and safety of student athletes. Football is a proven detriment to those who play it. It causes brain damage. Head injuries are a massive problem.
It causes joint damage that will be with them from their 30s and 40s on.
And we're in the business of improving people's brains, not injuring them. So to me, that really, there's so many levels, but the real basic one is, why are we supporting a sport that is proven to injure people?
Of course, with court decisions that are coming out about paying athletes, you could be seeing the whole idea of college athletics change greatly, probably in the next decade or two.
Might be a great reason to have a have an amicable divorce and split off our athletics from our university.
My guest today is Grant Jenkins, professor of English at the University of Tulsa. His book, Ivory Tower, is published by Atmosphere Press. It's a thriller that football is the backdrop. It's not the main part of the novel, but we did get off on the tangent there. One of the things I did want to ask you about is you're using sort of a hybrid self-publishing method to publish this novel. I wanted to ask about going that route. What was advantageous to it? I assume this novel is a little different than your traditional thriller. Mm-hmm. It does sort of take a circuitous route to that location. I could see where a traditional publisher wouldn't know what to do with it or would want you to make major changes to the structure. Why did you choose this route?
And I do think it has to do with genre. And my book plays with genre. It tries on different genres, even though I think ultimately I want it to be a kind of thriller that you're going to not want to put down and turn the page.
So the experimental poet is still there.
Absolutely. I've not given up on that. And I think a lot when I was sending it to agents and editors, I think their main question is, how am I going to sell this? And the key part to selling is a book is which shelf it's going to go on. I mean, it really is.
It really is.
Able to identify which shelf in the bookstore or which category they click on Amazon to take them there. And my book doesn't really fit. So I don't think a lot of those sort of representatives saw the value in the book, at least, you know, as something they wanted to represent. I got a lot of feedback like, you know, I really enjoyed it but it's not really my thing. And I worried about, you know, is it about, you know, because it's about football or has a female protagonist? I mean, there's a lot of things that it could explain that. Maybe it's a bad book. But, you know, I sent it to a colleague of mine who had started a new venture, Atmosphere Press, and his name's Nick Courtwright. And I said, take a look at it. What do you think? And he really liked it and got back with me. He explained the book to me in a way that I totally agreed with. He got it. He understood it. And, you know, we talked a lot about the business model he has. And what we mean by hybrid publishing when we say that is it's somewhere between a traditional publishing house and self-publishing. So traditional publishing houses, you would either somehow sell it to the editor of a publishing house or through a representative like an agent, get them to buy it, right? And then they would... They design it, they edit it, they control everything, and the author might get a percentage of sales or some sort of advance.
Some sort of royalty.
Right, yeah. On the back end. Usually fairly low, 15 to 10%, 50% at the highest if you're a big name, I would assume. The author has no control over design, over the cover, over title even. You essentially...
How it's marketed.
Right. You essentially sign all that way. But, you know, the advantage is you have a team... ideally from this publishing house who would try to, you know, hustle because
and they want to make money.
Yes, they want to make money and, you know, so all the ships rise. Self-publishing is exactly what it is. You pay for everything, you do everything from designing the cover to editing and all of that. Well, Atmosphere is in the middle in this hybrid sort of zone. That is, it's a selective press that doesn't just publish anything. It's not a vanity press. They offer editorial services, design services, cover, art, things like that, some promotion, and you pay for it. There's an investment up front for those services. And a lot of the hybrid, and you can, you know, Amazon even does this now where you can pay for certain levels of service that, you know, do you need an editor? Do you want a proofreader? Those kinds of things. You can sort of even a la carte, you know, all those services. And the advantage of doing, well, self-publishing or this kind of hybrid route is that I own all the rights. I was the final decision maker on all the design issues, and I will receive all the net profits from the novel, if there are any, you know, fingers crossed. And so it's a little bit more entrepreneurial. It's not totally, you're not totally alone, as you are with self-publishing. But ultimately, the risks and rewards are on you. And I had support from the university. I'm very appreciative to the English department, to the College of Arts and Sciences, and the provost office for their help in this investment. And, you know, I'm looking forward to, since this is my first novel, you know, learning the ropes of what it means to promote my own novel, because that's on me. I think there's also the advantage and disadvantage of this hybrid is that you are your own manager and you're on your own PR department. So I've been really hustling to get the word out about this book, getting reviews, getting the book in front of people before it comes out.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because publishing is one of the last realms of creative endeavor where you haven't had this, or you're starting to see a democratization of the art form. You know, music has had it for a number of years. You basically, most artists have to go out and self-publish their music now before a label will ever be interested in them. You have film that's had a democratization where mm-hmm. it used to have to go through a studio. Now anybody with cameras and friends can make a film, and a good-looking film oftentimes. Publishing is sort of that last, one of the last areas.
There's a couple of technological developments that I think that have opened up book publishing to this democratization that you're talking about that's happened with music and film and other arts. The first is the internet, of course. Sure. That is Amazon and other distribution services make it easy for anyone to put their work out there. Somebody can read it. Doesn't mean they will, but you can get it into a space where anyone can have access to it. That is really important. The second technology is print-on-demand technology, that bookstores don't have to order inventory and put their money down up front. They can, on, you know, when demand, you know, is there, they can order a certain number of copies. And there are distribution services like Ingram that will print your book. It's in a computer somewhere, and there's a print factory, and there's several across the world, Ingram, and there's other companies that do this as well. But somebody orders it, and that machine prints your book up right there. And so that technology has really allowed, has streamlined that sort of from the writer to the reader's hands, right, and made it cost effective to print a small run or to even upsize the run if it is a hit or a bestseller.
Mm. That's really interesting. And congratulations on the book, and hope it does really wonderfully. Grant, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Grant Jenkins is a professor of English at the University of Tulsa, where he teaches literature and creative writing, and he is the author of Ivory Tower, his first novel, which is published by Atmosphere Press. He'll be speaking about the book and signing it this evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.